I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. There's a line of work where the risks include toxic layers of gas and maze-like passageways. No, we're not talking about the halls of Congress. We're speaking of exploring submerged caves and something called blue holes. Today, we sit down with National Geographic cave diver Kenny Broad and learn why he spends so much time submerged, underground, under pressure, and underwater. We'll hear about how ancient life forms have been rediscovered and geological wonders revealed, and how this work probes issues ranging from climate change to the future of natural resources we all need to survive. We'll also ask if it's worth it to go on dives so dangerous that some say it's a good dive if you come back alive. It's Up to Date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. Steve Kraske is away. I'm Brian Ellison. There are some things that people do that you think, that is the most beautiful, breathtaking, awe-inspiring thing that I've ever seen, and sometime in my life I have to try that. And then there are other things where you look at it and you think, that is the most ridiculous, unthinkably dangerous thing I've ever seen, and you'd have to be crazy to try that. And sometimes it's both at the same time. So it is with extreme cave diving. Our guest today practices a job and a hobby where it is sometimes said that the mark of a successful day is just coming home alive. If you were tuning in to hear about JFK today, we're sorry that our guest James Giglio is out sick. However, we will talk later about the NAIA tournament, the basketball tournament that began this morning in Kansas City, so stay tuned for that. But first, cave diving. Kenny Broad is an environmental anthropologist whom you may have seen on the PBS series Nova. He'll be presenting a version of the show here in Kansas City, Extreme Cave Diving Live, part of the National Geographic Live series next Tuesday evening at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. He joins us this morning from WLRN in Miami. Kenny Broad, good morning.
Good morning, Brian. It's great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. So teach the uninitiated among us. What is cave diving?
Well, it's, I guess to a certain degree, the merging of going into the underground realm and then just pretend you're in the underground realm and then fill it with water.
Okay.
So get rid of all the air, the oxygen, and what may seem, I guess, to some people as a form of torture is actually, in some ways, it's easier than getting around in a dry cave where you actually have to use ropes and you're fighting gravity, whereas underwater, at least you have the advantage that you can swim.
You can levitate at will.
You can levitate, exactly. So you have much more three-dimensional range, but then you've got all the challenges of being in pitch dark or silty conditions or certainly having to keep a good watch on your gas supply.
Okay, so that sounds extreme enough to me, but what you practice has sometimes been called extreme cave diving. It doesn't seem to me like there's any other kind, but what is extreme cave diving? What do you do that makes it so extreme?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that term came about. I think it's got a little bit of a Hollywood sensationalism. I think you said it right. There's just really one type of cave diving, and whether you're going on a dive that you've been on 1,000 times or you're doing something for the first time in a place that there may be some unknowns, you're equally vigilant. So you still take the same precautions. You still follow the same golden rules. And I think what might maybe the extreme part it comes when you start getting into deeper depths or much further distances horizontally underground into the cave, or maybe trying to pull off conducting science and filmmaking while you're doing these dives.
Right. And we do want to talk about some of that, some of, as you said, the Hollywood aspect of this. But let's start with the fact that you're a real scientist. You have a PhD in anthropology. You do this for research, right?
Right. Well, at least I got my PhD, and I'm a professor at the University of Miami, and it's been a great kind of legitimizes what I've always loved, which is getting in the water, whether it's fresh water, salt water, whether it's underground or in a lake. But what's really amazing is you can jump into what seems like an insignificant muddy little hole in the ground and pull out information that's of value across a range of different scientific disciplines. So I by no means want to take credit for being the one doing all the science, but at least I've been lucky enough to be able to put together teams of different scientists, some of whom actually die, but most of whom are on the surface, that we bring back different samples. And I would say it's just these environments are probably the last untapped, what I would say, unexplored regions in the Earth that we still have to physically go there. Okay, you can't – there's nothing to substitute for the human decision-making, for our dexterity, or being able to make scientific judgments on the spot on what to sample and how to get in and out of these places. So there's still job security.
You can't send in a submarine into these spaces.
That's right. There's no remotely operated vehicles, or certainly not submarines, where manned submarines into most of the places we work, which is, you know, which I'm very glad for.
So let's talk about one of those places that you work, one that was featured in on some of these television shows, the blue holes. What is a blue hole?
Yeah, blue hole is the local terminology in the Bahamas for an underwater cave. So it's in – there's two types. There's holes that are out there in the ocean. Okay, they may be in a coral reef. They may be in a mangrove wetland area. And then there's inland holes that you might find in a forest. But they – essentially, they form the same way. If you think about it right now, if we go back about 18,000 years, the sea level was almost 20,000 – it was almost 400 feet lower. Wow. In many parts of the world, certainly Florida and Bahamas and these shallow limestone carbonate banks. So when you have the sea level much lower, you had a much larger area exposed to rain, and that rain would fall. The rain picks up a little bit of carbon dioxide through the atmosphere. It lands on the limestone, it eats it away, and you get these reservoirs of fresh water. Where that fresh water mixes with the salt water at the sea level, you also have horizontal cave formation. So you have caves forming wherever you have these sea level stands, and that's why we have quite deep caves that are actually now filled with salt water, or maybe out in the coral reef. It was just the sea level was lower then, and as sea level rises, they get flooded, and you have some that are left on land, but many are out in the ocean as well.
So the ones that are not filled with salt water, the ones that are freshwater on land, that's water that may have fallen there, that has been in that spot for centuries, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, we have some very old water, and then we have water that you can actually see the tannins from having just percolated through the limestone from the last big rainfall. So especially in the Bahamas, you tend to get a pretty quick turnover in mixing because it's a very thin, what we call the freshwater lens. And I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of coastal areas, that's what we have a freshwater lens, and that's our drinking water. It's not just an amazing reservoir for different sorts of microbes and rare species, and also preserves fossils, but it happens to be – that's our drinking water, and it's unfortunately it's out of sight, out of mind. It's beneath our feet, and we tend not to pay as much attention compared to the more, you know, charismatic bodies of water like lakes and beautiful surface streams.
So what's the attraction of these blue holes, these caves for diving? I mean, what can you do there that you couldn't do anywhere else?
Well, the attraction, I guess, do you want my rational answer, or do you
I want both.
You know, lying on a couch talking to a psychologist answer.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a good question. Let's come back to the psychology. What's your stated reason for doing this?
My stated reasons were, hopefully we were able to use tax dollars to fund our research through grants from different foundations.
Yeah.
Is that there's, I would say, there's probably four really, I think, key scientific questions that you can get out of a lot of these blue holes. It's not just the Bahamas. There's also some similar very large systems in the Yucatan, in Mexico, and in the Yucatan Peninsula, right, as well as in Florida and parts of Australia and other places in the world. But one is certainly the issue I mentioned, which is, where is our fresh water coming from? Where is it going? What are the level of pollutants? What are the threats, either naturally or from anthropogenically, from humans that are affecting this water source? Because remember, if you take away the water that's locked up in ice, 95% of the world's fresh water comes from groundwater beneath our feet from these aquifers. Okay, so there's the, call it the hydrology groundwater human element.
And the benefit here is that this is an example of that groundwater that's actually available to us for exploration, which most of it is not.
That's right. Or at least you have to drill extremely deep and to get to it, whereas we're literally swimming through not only our water supply, but often where we dump our waste, for example, from deep well injection and things like that of wastewater. So and simply, you know, if you put a chicken farm or dairy somewhere that has this very porous limestone, you know, you have to watch out because very, very quickly we'll taint our own drinking supply.
Okay, so that's one, the groundwater and exploring this important natural resource, that's one benefit. What else are you getting out of this?
We're also getting out of this, so I work very closely with different cave biologists. One of them actually is a cave explorer, Tom Iliff, at Texas A&M University. And they're extremely rare species, particularly of crustaceans, that we think have been unchanged for over 200 million years that are found in these cave systems. And they're so rare that some of them have only been found not just in underwater caves, not just in underwater caves on one island, not just on several caves on one island, but only one cave. So how have they survived for 200 million years through sea level fluctuations in these, you know, what we consider very harsh environments of no oxygen, no light, minimal sorts of inputs to gain energy from? So how are these creatures, how are they surviving? Where
Good
did
question.
They come from?
How are they surviving?
And how are they? Well, the problem is they're very difficult to study in the lab to try to reproduce the kind of conditions that you get underground. So you do it by kind of, I would say, a process of reduction of what's, you know, what similar conditions are they living in? Is there some form of nitrates or bacteria, or are there other creatures around them that they may be feeding on? Where do we find them aggregated? Do we find them only in certain conditions after certain rain types of rainfall?
So have you found yourself any of these rare or even unique species?
Yes, our team, just to give you a sense, the Bahamas is probably the biodiversity hotspot of the, you know, of the world in terms of cave creatures. And I believe, well, it was in the 1970s that a new class of crustaceans, which is a major finding, took place in the Bahamas. And since then, you know, dozens of new species have been found, and some of them by, you know, by our team on different expeditions.
Sure. We should mention that we're talking with Kenny Broad, who's an environmental anthropologist and a cave diver, talking about his work in blue holes in caves, and also his work coming up next Tuesday at the Kauffman Center as he talks about extreme cave diving live. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. If you want to join the conversation, if you have a question for Kenny Broad, or I don't know if there's any cave divers out there yourselves, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org. We actually have a call already. I want to continue, Kenny, to have you tell me about some of the actual scientific benefits of doing this, besides the fact that it's fun. But let's take this call from David, who's actually listening online. He's in San Francisco. David, good morning.
Hey, greetings. You know, great topic. You know, I wanted to ask him about what kind of pollution he sees, or if he's ever gone into data collection. As I understand it, and especially in Missouri, there are a lot of underwater rivers virtually. I'm originally from St. Louis, and I remember back in the 70s and 80s, there were studies showing that I think they had put some dyes in a laundry mat, and then the water that was being dumped into a creek was showing up down in Arkansas on the other side of rivers. The dyes wouldn't make it into the river, but that the dye would show up miles and miles away in someone's spring in the
through the groundwater.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I'm noticing as oil wells get run out, they start pumping huge amounts of water down into the oil well in order to float the last oil, and they can suck it out of there. And so the idea that all of this filthy water, or this water is being filthified, so to speak, down in underground, and I'm wondering how it's starting to travel around.
Okay, good question, David. Kenny Broad, do you see pollution in these caves that you explore?
Yeah, David brings up a really, really great examples, and unfortunately, we're seeing more and more. In fact, it's very rare now when you get to anywhere that's near an urban area, even small, relatively small towns or settlements, that you don't see some sort of pollution. And they may be in the form of nitrates that come from fertilizers. It could be pesticides that all of a sudden a farm will go in or a dairy will go in somewhere, and where there was a lot of cave life dies off extremely quickly. So that's the kind of superficial aquifer level, the part that we're diving through. When you start getting into the issues that David's talking about with oil exploration, or now with the controversy about fracking, which involves pumping large amounts of fluids with all sorts of chemicals down deep, we really are finding out more and more that there's this may be a bit exaggerated, but there's almost no such thing as a confined underground space. Eventually, things make their way out, particularly, you know, in limestone, which is where a lot of our drinking water is found. So you can get contamination that makes its way into drinking water systems from deeper below, or what you see more frequently is from the surface. In terms of, I mean, and that's in some ways microscopic, but in the case of underwater caves where you have inland holes, people actually use them often as dumping grounds. I mean, the sinkholes, I'm sure people have examples from Missouri.
Actually dump right into the caves.
You dump right into them. And we've seen everything from cars, swing sets, 50-gallon drums full of chemicals. I mean, there's a lot of places that we're unable to dive or we've gotten sick from diving in there.
That must be quite a startling underwater discovery when you encounter a swing set underwater.
No, that's right. I have a very, very clear recollection of being fairly far back, you know, more than 1,000 feet in a cave, and a piece of a swing set that had caught a bunch of plastic bags. So it looked a bit like ghosts all hanging out, floating midwater, and it was startling.
Kenny, you've gone on how many of these dives? How many of these expeditions would you say?
Oh, I think well over 1,000 dives into underwater caves.
You must enjoy it. It's fun.
Oh yeah.
Is it scary as well? I mean, it's very dangerous.
I mean, you'd like to think of it in terms that you're managing all the different risks that I mentioned earlier, but I guess, if it was scary, I definitely wouldn't do it. I don't like scary movies. I don't like bungee jumping. If anything, it's probably the opposite. I'm a bit of a control freak. So to me, it's in some ways the ultimate endeavor, where you're combining a physical activity with also with many technical aspects as you plan the dive, as you manage your gases and running different computers underwater. You're also able to do science. So you're in this almost zone of focus that I don't get anywhere on the surface, and it's all this combination of things, at least, that draws me to the activity.
So, I guess I have to ask. It was part of the PBS series reported that it is not unusual that part of this work involves recovering bodies, including the bodies. I understand you've been involved in recovering more than 100 bodies. Of dead cave divers.
I think what they reported was they looked at all the recoveries that were done by people on our team.
So not just you individually.
Where they came up with – no, definitely not.
Yeah. But still, that's a sizable number. I mean, even one of your close colleagues who – last year you were named Explorer of the Year together with a photographer, Wes Skiles, who died diving after that. How can you possibly keep doing this when that's such a big part of what's happening?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer, and there's times when, you know, you've lost very close friends or been in just what feel like the most horrible situation in the world on expeditions where something's gone wrong. But there is some allure that's inexplicable that draws you back in, and no doubt there's probably elements of, you know, again, for the psychologists out there, there's elements of denial where you think it can't happen to me. I'm 45 years old. I don't. No one loves their family more than I do. But there's something that, will can't stop me from going to these places. Now, that said, I think I go into these environments with a much healthier attitude than I used to when I was younger and more carefree and before friends died in these places. And I feel like I don't have to personally prove myself to set a record anymore or push a certain cave beyond a certain limit. And I'm much more attracted now to what I would say is pulling out the information and the science and the public education about our, you know, this out of sight, out of mind resource than I am to, you know, pushing limits of what I can do underwater, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also post on KCUR's Facebook page or send us a tweet at KCUR UpToDate. I'm curious, Kenny, how you got started in this. What made you say for the first time, you know, I want to dive in an underground cave?
You know, I grew up in Miami, my kind of ancestral village, and we're surrounded by water. And all I ever wanted to do was be in the water, be underwater. And as much as I actually don't even have TV or let my kids watch TV,
really?
But I realized it was, you know, the Jacques Cousteau episodes. It was certain shows that actually kind of said, oh, wow, you can actually do this as a profession, it's not just something you ride your bike and jump in the water on the weekends and do. So in some ways, I think the PhD of diving is cave diving.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most technical. It's the most demanding. It takes the most practice.
Well, and how
and
is that?
Control.
How is that so? I mean, what is different from, you know, the people who go out diving on their Caribbean vacation
and look at
coral reefs? I mean, what are you doing that's all that different?
So basically, when we go open water diving, there's plenty of rules to follow, and it also takes proper training. No one should just go jump in the water. But if you have a problem, you can come right up to the surface. Okay, you may have to make a stop if you've accumulated a lot of nitrogen in your bloodstream. But eventually you can make it up to the surface. You know where the surface is at all times.
Mm-hmm.
If you stir up the bottom, we generally know which way is up. Well, in an underwater cave, you have to come out the same way you went in. And that might be not just tight, narrow passages, but they also may be very complex, almost a braided maze that you've gone in that looks very different when you turn around and come out the other way. They're also, because they don't get a lot of flow, many of the caves, they're full of extremely fine, thin silt that even using proper techniques, which are different kicking techniques than in the open water, you still, just your bubbles or just the pressure of the water, your body pushing a pressure wave of water ahead of you, will turn the visibility to zero. Hmm. So you're coming out sometimes thousands of feet with no visibility.
So how do you navigate underwater then?
So right. So one of the golden rules is you run a continuous guideline from the surface. And it takes a lot of skill to run a proper guideline, and it takes a certain amount of, I would say, kind of mental control when you know you have a limited air supply or gas supply to come out on that line, which is much slower than how you went in and saw your way in. And there's, especially if you're diving with other people, you have touch signals and all sorts of kind of other skill sets to learn that you don't need in the open water. As well, again, in open water, you kind of know how long it takes you to ascend from a certain depth, whereas it may take much longer when you're coming from underground and find your way out. So we have very strict gas rules. So if I'm wearing – you always wear at least two tanks and often several tanks with independent regulators, the apparatus that you breathe out of. And you may only use a third of each tank on your way in, a third coming out, or a third for emergencies. But in a particularly, you know, hairy or challenging dive, you might only use, you know, a fifth of your gas supply going in and keep all the rest for coming out. So there's a whole element of managing all your different tanks. There's watching computers for decompression. That's, you have to stop at certain depths to let the nitrogen or helium get out of your system.
How long
so
is this?
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Yeah. How long does this take typically? How long is the typical dive? How long are you underwater?
Well, I guess there really is no such thing as a typical dive, but at least for a lot of our science dives in the Nat Geo expedition that was recently featured, I'd say that average dive were about 2 hours at a depth of about, maybe 100 feet, but they range from almost, 300 feet deep to some shallower to 50 feet deep. So, and we use a range of open circuit scuba, which is kind of your standard scuba tank. But when you're breathing out of a scuba tank, remember, you take a breath and your body is only metabolizing about 3 to 5% of the 21% oxygen in there. And the rest goes out in the form of bubbles. So you could think of it almost as you're wasting all that gas. And there's a technology called rebreathers where you can recirculate your own breath, take out the carbon dioxide, which you don't want, inject some more oxygen or whatever the mix of diving gases you do want, and you can stay a lot longer because you're not losing these bubbles. But it also comes with its own kind of equipment challenges using this.
Yeah. Well, when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Kenny Broad about what else scientifically is to be gained from cave diving, as well as the experience. We also want to talk a little bit about the beauty of the experience, and you can check out some pictures from underwater cave diving online at our website, kcur.org. You'll also find a link there to the PBS series or PBS program that featured Kenny Broad and other divers as they underwent this this experience and risked their lives to get this information. We'll continue the conversation when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with Alain de Botton about religion for atheists, you can find that online at kcur.org. And tune in tomorrow for a visit with the author and family behind the book and the movie Blood Done Sign My Name, the story of a white preacher and his family following the murder of a black man in their small southern town in 1970. That and the weekend to-do list tomorrow on Up to Date. Coming up later this morning, we'll take a look at the NAIA basketball tournament that is underway this morning in Kansas City. But first, we're talking about cave diving with Kenny Broad. He is an underwater cave diver and also an environmental anthropologist. He's offering a program next Tuesday at the Kauffman Center called Extreme Cave Diving Live, part of the National Geographic Live series, and tickets are available online for that. Kenny, you were telling us before the break about some of the scientific benefits, the things that you discovered. We talked about learning more about natural resources like fresh water and about some of the rare or even unique zoological finds that you find underwater. What else is important? What other scientific benefit is there to underwater cave diving?
Yeah, there are a few others to briefly mention. One is certainly that we can learn a lot about what we think the earliest forms of life were like here on Earth. If you go back about 3.5 billion years ago, most of the life or the life on the planet was microbial bacteria. Mm-hmm. And we think that the blue holes, particularly in the Bahamas, are kind of modern day analogs for what these ancient oceans were like. So they have unique biogeochemistries. They have hydrogen sulfide gases. They've got anoxic, so no oxygen, but salt water. So what's living in these things in the Bahamas, and they may be very different forms of bacteria and microbes from island to island or even from a blue hole just a few miles away, these are kind of the modern context where we can try to study these ancient microbes because they didn't leave a fossil record. And there are other places, but they're very in the deep ocean, so they're much harder to study. In this case, we can dive in them and be directed by the scientists. So in this case, Jen McAlady from Penn State University leads the microbiology. We go down, we take pictures, we bring samples. We can actually run hoses down to depths where she can suck up some of these microbes and study them in field labs and then direct the science right there. So there's a lot to learn from an kind of evolutionary standpoint there as well.
Sure.
Two other of the major scientific goals. One, these when you have no oxygen, you have salt water, it's a perfect preservative for fossils. So we found a lot of animal and human remains. So Dave Stedman from the Florida Museum of Natural History, he really led the paleontology. And I think we found about over 25 species that either were were not known to science or we did not know existed in this part of the Caribbean, and found some of the oldest Paleo-Indian remains as well.
So it sounds a little like an archaeological dig, except without the digging.
That's right. So they're still digging underwater because, remember, some of these areas were dry for thousands of years.
Hmm.
So, you know, if someone had set up a campsite or a cook site or an animal had killed a bunch of prey and all the bones that lay there, eventually over thousands of years, they get covered with silt and sediment and organic matter that falls into these holes. So what we do is we look for certain areas where we think it makes sense from the kind of geology and the angle of the slopes, and we start digging in these areas. So it's kind of slow, painstaking work.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you want to talk with Kenny Broad, who is an underwater cave diver. 235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org. We had a caller before the break. He's not there anymore, but he asked if you've done any cave or mine diving in the Midwest. Have you ever dove out here?
Actually, I've been in southern Missouri in a couple mines many, many years ago, and we were actually filming a reenactment of a diver who had gotten lost, but actually was they made their way out. But I would love to do some caving in your state. But I'm kind of a wimp. I like the warm tropical water.
Right,
so I gotta admit, I'd be complaining a lot.
The Bonterre mine outside of St. Louis is one that someone mentioned as
Well, maybe when I'm in Kansas City next week, someone will take me underground.
All right. Well, we'll have to look pretty hard in Kansas City, I think. But there might be some mines around. We'll check it out for you. I'd be curious. This is radio, of course, so people can't see some of these gorgeous pictures, although we are posting some of them online. But I have to think that as breathtakingly beautiful as the photography is, it probably doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of what you see when you're down there.
No, that's right. It's this three-dimensional kind of sensory experience, not just going through pitch blackness and this feeling often of, well, I'm the first one ever to see this. I mean, that alone kind of can overwhelm your senses.
Yeah.
But just the sheer beauty of the cave formations, of crystals, of stalagmites and stalactites, those are the ones that come up from the ground like spikes, and the colors that you see, because the minerals and dust that gets trapped in these things refract through the lights that you're bringing down there, it's otherworldly, and it's otherworldly the same way that you might go into a beautiful, you know, European cathedral, but you can swim from one end up to a detail, you know, 100 feet away, see it, then swim back down. So you really feel like you're in this kind of inner space world, and you can experience it in a way that you can't do that on above ground. And I think the magazine just had amazing photos, and I just want to say that, you know, Wes Giles, he actually was one of the early pioneers in cave diving and then in cave photography and filmmaking. He was working in the harshest environments on Earth and creating these amazing imageries. It's one thing to go there and make your way back out. It's another thing to go there, do science, and make your way back out. He would go in, do science and amazing photography, and make his way back out. And he really was our mentor for many of us in the field. And it was probably, you know, it was a personal loss and a loss to the community.
One of Wes Giles' photos, and actually others I've seen from underwater diving, show sort of a red curtain almost that the diver is swimming through. What is that red curtain? What is happening there?
Right. When I was talking about how these are modern day analogs for the ancient oceans, one of the reasons is these layers of hydrogen sulfide. So hydrogen sulfide is, you know, sometimes we call it sewer gas, that sulfur smelling stuff that you see that you can smell at springs. Well, it actually, you get a layer of that gets trapped, and it's a byproduct of the microbes down at the bottom that are decomposing the organic matter. And you then also have microbes that live inside of this hydrogen sulfide, and they get their energy from the hydrogen sulfide. And what you're seeing in these psychedelic pink and green swirls that look like kind of the rings of Saturn as you descend through them, those are actually the colors, the pigments in the cells of the bacteria. So it's very otherworldly. And in fact, as you're underwater and you've got a mask on, you've got a regulator in your mouth, but you get this same rotten egg smell because the hydrogen sulfide is actually diffusing through your skin and then picked up in your olfactory nerves.
Mm.
So you have this bizarre sensation, and you actually don't want to stay in it too long, or you know, you start to get a headache, and you can actually get nauseous. And I imagine if you stay long enough, you'll do the funky chicken like happens on land when you'll convulse.
Wow, which just adds to the list of risks that one doesn't want to think about having to deal with underwater.
Yeah, it's another one that will keep some people out, luckily. But it's also what leads to, you know, it's the bacteria that are living in that hydrogen sulfide layer that are using up some of the oxygen. And that's one of the reasons why we have such perfect preservation, kind of a rare chemistry down beneath that layer. So
one of the most breathtaking pictures I saw gets at another of the phenomena that occur down there, and it's the vortex. There's a picture of a diver swimming right up to what looks like a giant underwater whirlpool. What's happening there?
Yeah, that's right. That's, to me, still, I grew up reading the Odyssey, Ulysses, where there were these vortices out there, and I always thought, oh my God, that's amazing, but it's fiction. But actually, you know, half a mile offshore in the Bahamas, you have some holes in the middle of the reef that on a certain tide will blow out water from, you know, maybe 70 feet deep, and on the opposite tide, it'll suck a small boat down.
Wow.
So that's another – add that to the challenges is you want to time your dives properly. Otherwise, you're on a one-way voyage.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, has there ever been a time when you thought, uh-oh, this is it? This is my one-way voyage?
Why'd you remind me of that? There have been some times for different reasons where – it crosses your mind that you're going to have a problem coming out, whether it was a line that got cut, or another instance where actually one of these tides turned at a different time than I was anticipating, and it was a real struggle to get out. I've had a couple of those, one time with bad gas. But you tend to, when you're actually in the moment, I think part of the big mental challenge is you don't let the idea that you're not going to make it out enter your thoughts. You're really trained. You're better off training in yoga than you are, for instance, in weightlifting. It's really about keeping your breathing rate calm no matter what happens and kind of sorting your way out as opposed to any kind of rapid panic. And if you start thinking, I'm not going to make it out, that's probably the first step toward the panic freak out.
I'm curious if cave diving for you has changed the way you live on land.
Oh, that's a great question. It has, and it actually has changed kind of some of my interest academically. And I work a lot on the issue of perception of risk, particularly risk of environmental problems. And I think a lot of what I learned in cave diving, which is a very kind of rigorous approach to risk management and really trying to balance the way that we're driven by emotions with an analytic approach to something, because it's back to what I said before. You can't let yourself panic. You can't get pulled into a situation and want to stay down somewhere because of the beauty, because you've got a schedule to be on. You can't let yourself slip. There's no room for error while you have a lot of these distractions. I think a lot of the problems we face in natural resource management kind of parallel at least some of the cognitive biases that make you vulnerable when you're diving. So these same sorts of issues that, okay, I'm responding to what I see right in front of me as opposed to what's actually maybe happening further in time. So climate change is a good example of that where, okay, it's hard for me to think about what may happen in 50 years, 100 years. Water resources are out of sight, out of mind, so we don't worry about them. We haven't had a lot of evolutionary trial and error in what's happened with these potentially catastrophic environmental problems. And the way we learned in cave diving, unfortunately, has been trial and error and fatalities that we change our systems and change our rules. And I think there's a lot of parallels in both of those realms.
What's next for you, Kenny? When's your next dive, and what's the next frontier for you in cave diving?
Well, one of the major findings that I didn't mention from the expedition was we recovered geologic samples, particularly the stalagmites, the ones that grew up from the bottom. They end up being amazing recorders of environmental history, particularly the temperature and rainfall. So what we're finding, and these are my colleagues at the University of Miami, Peter Swart, who's a geochemist, we're finding that the climate changed very abruptly within a relatively short time frame. So I'm talking the period of decades of rapid cooling and warming. And we've seen that in other records in the ice and a few other lake sediments, but we're seeing it very distinctly and in an area where it hasn't been seen before, in an area that's critical for global climate, because the North Atlantic is where a lot of the ocean circulation that controls our global climate takes place. So that, combined with massive amounts of Saharan dust that we're finding in the cave that coincide with these climate changes, we're launching a very ambitious research program to understand these abrupt climate changes, because they're very real threats and they're on a time scale that we all should be concerned about.
Yeah. Kenny Broad is a professor at the University of Miami. He's an environmental anthropologist, and he'll be presenting next Tuesday evening here in Kansas City, Extreme Cave Diving Live. That's at Helzberg Hall in the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. He joined us this morning from WLRN in Miami. Kenny, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Coming up next, a look at the NAIA basketball tournament. And we're joined by KCUR's Greg Eklund, who covers sports for KCUR. And we're going to talk today about the NAIA basketball tournament, which is underway this morning in Kansas City. And for those of you trying to keep track at home, Shorter College is currently leading Life College 53-41 with the second half just underway. Greg, good morning.
You know, it's not uncommon, Brian, for someone who works downtown to take their lunch break by walking over to Municipal Auditorium and watching a basketball game for their lunch break and then heading back to the office.
And it doesn't really matter who's playing the game sometimes,
does it? That's right. The latest game tonight will start at 10:30. The first game started at 9 this morning,
which featured Roger State of Oklahoma and, Tougaloo from Mississippi, I think.
I didn't see the result of that, did you?
I think Roger State walked away with it as the game went on. So.
And that's the thing about it. You have your seedings for this tournament as you do for the NCAA, but you don't have the eye test until you go and actually see them play,
right?
Because you don't have these teams aren't televised when you reel off names like Martin Methodist of Tennessee and Our Lady of the Lake in Texas. I mean, who really knows how good they are? So there is a seeding system, but you frequently have a lot of seeded teams being knocked off because right. Nobody knows how good that opponent really is going into this tournament.
Right. You know, is that part of the charm of this tournament, Greg, that it isn't really about the teams, the personalities, the NBA prospects of the players?
It really is. I mean, the coaches are the ones who do the laundry. You know, they're operating on shoestring budgets. They order their food from the local deli, you know, as their meal on the way back to the hotel or something. So, I mean, it's this is really grassroots basketball at its best.
Now, of course, that wasn't always the case with the NAIA tournament, right? This used to be the big show, right?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way, that there have been a lot of NAIA schools that have turned into NCAA Division II and Division III programs. So the membership of the NAIA has been reduced, and you don't have the potential NBA players now that you had 20 years ago when Dennis Rodman was here in Kansas City playing for Southeastern Oklahoma, and then you had another Terry Porter for playing for Wisconsin Stevens Point.
Right.
So at that time, you had some potential NBA players here, but that's not really the case that much anymore.
Right. And a lot of those schools make the move from the NAIA to the NCAA
right.
Division II or something like that.
That is correct. Yeah, I mean, you had Washburn, Fort Hays State, and a lot of schools in Kansas that were part of District 10 that are now part of NCAA Division II.
Right. William Jewell College even made that
move. That's correct. They just recently made that conversion.
Now, I will say there are some local teams in the tournament, though.
Yes, we have a Mid-America Nazarene of Olathe, Baker of Baldwin City, Evangel from Springfield, Missouri, and Columbia College from Columbia, Missouri. So there is some local interest here.
So not too far away. Mm-hmm. This is the 75th anniversary of the tournament this year, and of course it's got a pretty storied history, doesn't it?
Well, it really does. I mean, this goes back to 1937 when Dr. James Naismith wanted to get a tournament like this
put together. The inventor of basketball.
That's right. And he passed away in 1939, so 2 years after he saw the infancy of this tournament before the NCAA tournament took place, he saw the potential of getting a lot of teams together. At that time, I believe it was only 8 teams. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, it was the grassroots for the tournament that unfolded with the NIT, the NCAA, and as we are ongoing, the NAIA.
The NAIA, of course, has its national headquarters here in Kansas City, mm-hmm. right there in the Power and Light District, and they actually have on display a scorebook from one of those first tournaments still there in their lobby.
Yeah, a lot of rich history here. The NAIA for a few years tried to move the tournament and tried to make it go in Tulsa. They found out that it was a failure. It has returned to Kansas City, back to its roots.
I understand John Wooden, famous of his UCLA days, but had a big part of his early days of basketball coaching in connection with the NAIA.
Everybody will remember Indiana State as a team synonymous with Larry Bird, but John Wooden was a player for Indiana State when I'm pretty sure that he was a player at that time.
That might be right.
If my facts are correct, Wooden was a player for Indiana State before his coaching days. And then, of course, the building has a lot of great history because this is where John Wooden won his first Final Four
right.
as a coach in 1964 with UCLA.
And that actually, the building is part of the story, isn't it? Municipal
it really
auditorium.
Is.
You know, you've
yeah.
got just down the street at the Sprint Center, the Big 12 tournament, getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of resources down there. It's a very different environment at the municipal auditorium.
It is, and you won't have the inflow of cash from patrons that you did from last weekend with the Big 12 tournament. Nonetheless, a lot of teams. Are frequenting the businesses in and around the Power and Light District, and there still is a lot of brisk business, shall we say, around the downtown area from the participants and from the fans that follow them, usually a small pocket of fans.
Well, in fact, you've got 32 teams all staying at the Marriott there downtown, I believe.
Yep.
Talk about the tournament itself. You've got 32 teams. What happens in these 6 days?
Well, this is called the toughest tournament because a team to win the national championship at the NAIA, it will be playing 5 games in roughly 6 days. Mm. There are the first rounds take place today and tomorrow, where 8 games are down at Municipal today, 8 more games tomorrow, and then it's whittled down to the quarters, semis, and the championship game next Tuesday night.
So it's a lot of action in a short amount of time. It's more an endurance test than the NCAA tournament.
It really is. I mean, and that's why it's called the toughest tournament.
And who are the big teams to watch this year? Who should we be expecting to hear about?
Well, again, you know, you'd never know with the seedings, but the number one seeded team is probably that game that's ongoing right now. Shorter, Georgia, is the number one seeded team in this tournament. The number two seeded team in this tournament plays at 10:30 tonight. That's Oklahoma Baptist against Belhaven of Mississippi.
And I got to tell you, Greg, full disclosure here, I go to this tournament every year, and you know, Oklahoma Baptist, they're a longtime participant in this tournament. They've been in the championship game a couple times, but Shorter College came out of nowhere this year. They've not even been in the tournament the last several years, and here they are, the number one seed.
I mean, you do have your teams that are your NAIA traditionalists. Another one that you'd a lot of fans who follow this would recognize is Mountain State of West Virginia. They've
yes.
won some national championships here. They seem to be almost a perennial national contender here. For the record, Mountain State is here. They're seeded 11th.
And I assume you've done your bracket, Greg, entered your office pool. who's in your championship game?
I haven't filled out my bracket for the NAIA, Brian. I must confess.
Haven't got that done quite yet. Well, I appreciate your willingness to come in and spend a few minutes talking with us about the tournament. That's KCUR's Greg Eklund. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Brian.
The NAIA tournament continues all day today and tomorrow and Friday, and then culminates with the championship Tuesday night at Municipal Auditorium. You can find bios of all of our guests, archives of our broadcasts, as well as podcasts here at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Just checking in on the score, about 16 minutes remaining in the second half. Shorter College leads Life College 60-46. Tomorrow on the program, the story of how one white family responded to the killing of a black man in their small southern town. Our music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance Concert Jazz Band. We had help today from KCUR's Kathleen Pointer, Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.